I was originally asked to give a talk on lists in Buddhism, and I couldn't get very inspired by that. It seemed a bit boring, really, and I'm sure somebody could probably make a lot of it. But in fact, I will talk about that to some extent. But while I was thinking about that topic, it occurred to me that it is very interesting the way Buddhism structures itself. In other words, what's the overall pattern of teachings in Buddhism? What's the approach of Buddhism in terms of its framework that it tries to offer you to understand your life and to understand your practice? So I thought I'd give a little bit of a talk about that. And it sounds rather a grand title, The Structure of Buddhism. It's going to be a little bit like work in progress. I'm not saying I've really got fully to grips with this, but at least we can look at it together and see what we think about it. If there is one symbol of Buddhism, it's the wheel of Dharma, the Dharma chakra. And this is a wheel of Dharma with the eight spokes, one spoke for each of the limbs of the Noble Eightfold Path. And sometimes there's other symbolism with it as well. So you can see that visual structure. And I'll talk a little bit about visual emblems that are used in Buddhism, but mainly I'm going to talk about the more verbal and intellectual structure that's used in Buddhism. And I hope it'll stimulate some interest and stimulate some questions, and I hope some of it at least will be useful. And as I was thinking about this, as I was imagining what it must have been like at the very beginning of Buddhism, when a group of people were trying to start what they felt at least was a very, very radically new approach to dealing with the issues of being a human being. And the way the Buddha himself put it was that he felt that human life was unsatisfactory. There was a lot wrong with it. That our experience was of things missing, of things not being complete, of something being wrong. And he felt that was a real issue. And he tried to deal with it in his own life, in his own practice, and felt he had successfully done so. But he didn't feel satisfied with that, and he wanted to try to tackle those issues for other people as well. At least point people in a direction that might be helpful for them in dealing with unsatisfactoriness, in dealing with this issue of lack. And one of the first things he came across, if not the first, was the crucial nature of mindfulness, of actually being present while your life happens. A lot of dukkha, he felt, was to do with not being there while it's going on, being preoccupied with the future or the past, and not dwelling in the present, paradoxically, often because it can be quite uncomfortable to be fully there with your present experience. So discomfort is caused by avoiding discomfort, strangely enough. Now, this is a very, very simple teaching. And in our men's chapter on Sunday, we had a very interesting discussion about it, I thought, looking at this basic teaching of what you might call be here now. I think it's what Aldous Huxley called the perennial philosophy. You'll find it in many different spiritual traditions, that teaching of just drop your concerns, your preoccupations, and try to really arrive, really be there while it's happening, which means now, which means in this instant. And if you don't manage to do it now, then you have to do it now. And if you don't manage to do it now, then the only other time to do it is now. That's right, yeah. And anyway, it's so simple, isn't it? What more can be said? I mean, huge numbers of books have been written about this. We were talking about a number of people like Eckhart Tolle, who has this approach. And also, I think, Krishnamurti, another teacher, with a very strong Indian but not specifically Buddhist background, who also, you know, you look at the books he wrote about it, huge numbers of them, but in a way they're all trying to make the same point. And you'll find it very, very centrally there in Buddhism. In Buddhism, it is known as the practice of mindfulness, trying to actually be there while it's going on. And you might say, why do you need any more structure than that? Isn't that enough? And I did find this very interesting in our discussion that we did come up with. Buddhism has got some other angles in a way, on trying to understand life and trying to understand experience and trying to come to terms with things. In a way, it says mindfulness is central and crucial, but you also need to be doing something a little bit more actively. You need to be, at least at times, working on yourself. And the reason for that is that it's all very well just saying, be here now, but we've got very, very strong habits that tend to generate avoidance mechanisms of various kinds. And it may be that you need to deal with those habits in systematic practice ways. So that's why you have count to 10 in the first stage of the mindfulness of breathing, or even doing the mindfulness of breathing and doing the metta bhavana, because in a way you're trying to tackle those avoidance habits that we've got that keep us away from just being completely in the illumined reality of awareness itself, which I suppose is what it would be like if you're enlightened. That would be just there the whole time. So you need those systematic approaches. You need to be working in some way, at least sometimes. But another thing that you need is sangha. It's important to cultivate connections with the kind of people that are going to be helping you to be in that illumined present awareness. So they're not contradicting the value of mindfulness, but in a way they're saying there may be a little bit more to it. And it's out of those other strands in Buddhism, it seems to me, that the system of Buddhism comes. You don't need any system if you're just saying, be here now. But you do need a system if you're saying, deal with those avoidance mechanisms, deal with those problematic states of mind and habits that we do tend to have. So in a way, that's what Buddhism was constructed in order to do. And maybe the construction sometimes went a little bit too far. So again, going back to that early beginning of Buddhism and trying to work out how they started constructing this system, this edifice, I thought of a number of different approaches that were taken by the Buddha himself and by others at the beginning of Buddhism. And I want to give you some examples of these. The first one is having an exchange with people. In this case, the Buddha had an exchange with a group of people who had an issue, a problem. And I'm going to read this one out. This is quite famous, but I'm going to read it out anyway, in case you haven't heard it before. The Kalamas said to the Buddha, "Certain spiritual aspirants and priests visit our town. They only explain and illuminate their own teachings, condemning, abusing, and pulling to pieces the teachings of others. Then different ones visit and do the same thing. We're in doubt and uncertainty about them. Which of them told the truth and which of them spoke falsely?" And the Buddha replies, "You're definitely right to be in doubt and uncertainty, Kalamas. This matter is a doubtful one. So, don't rely on what you hear repeatedly, nor on what's handed down in a tradition, nor on hearsay, nor should you rely on a scripture as an authority, nor on sophistical arguments or logical inference, nor on prolonged consideration, nor on indulgence in the pleasure of speculation, nor on someone making a plausible impression, nor on your respect for a spiritual teacher. Don't rely on these things. Instead, Kalamas, when you know of yourselves that these teachings or these states of mind are unskillful, blamable, they're faulted by sensible people, and that followed through in practice they tend to harm and frustration, then give them up. But if you know that they're the opposite of this, then practice them and follow them through." So I gave that partly because it's an example of this question and answer process, a method of arriving at a useful understanding by talking to a master and asking questions, but also, of course, because it illustrates the whole issue of people coming around with different sets of teachings and how do you determine what you go for. And in a way, he says, you go for what actually works. Try it out. See what effect it has. Do, by all means, listen to sensible people, as they put it. You don't have to be on your own with this, but also just see what does it actually lead to. What are its results when you put it into practice? So that's the first example of the approach taken in early Buddhism. The second one I call delivering a lecture. And this is something that the Buddha and, again, other early Buddhists would quite often do. They just call together the local disciples and they'd say, right, sit down, shut up and listen. And here's one example of this. And I'll give this example because this does tie into what we'll be doing next on Tuesday evenings. On one occasion, the Buddha addressed the monks. Monks, he said, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for the attainment of the right method, and for the realization of enlightenment. What is that direct path? In other words, the foundations of mindfulness. So this is where he taught mindfulness, but he taught it not just saying, be here now, but he divided it up. He produced a list, the four foundations of mindfulness, and we're going to be looking at these over the next few weeks. But then another system that was sometimes used was reciting poetry, and I think this one shouldn't be neglected. So I'm going to give an example of this, also from the Buddha. Most of these examples are from the Buddha himself, because we've got the most extensive records of his teachings. So here's his poem. Far-ranging is the mind, and it walks alone. It is not material. It sleeps in the cave of your heart. Keep it controlled, and you'll be free from the bonds of death. And I believe that in Pali, that Pali poetry is very rhythmic. They don't use rhyme, they use rhythm. So I'm not good enough at Pali to recite that in Pali, but it sounds very beautiful. And the early Buddhists used a lot of other methods of teaching. Sometimes they told stories. Sometimes they used images. Not making use of my visual aids here. There's the Kalama one. You can find this on the web if you want to read through it again. I won't give us a chance to, at the moment, to read through the whole thing. This is the one about the foundations of mindfulness, a lecture. And here's the poem, which is from the Dhammapada. And another example I came across, this is from later Buddhism, from Tibetan Buddhism, is the use of sort of what you might call allegorical images. So if you look carefully, you'll see this looping path going up the mountain, and there are snapshots of an elephant and a flame and a monkey and a monk. If you look carefully, you'll see all those creatures there. And can you see what's happening to the elephant? He's getting bleached. He's gradually getting bleached. And the monkey in the higher reaches vanishes away. And this is the teaching system that they're using here, just using these images. And then, of course, they give this is the explanation that came with it. I'm not going to go into it, but it's interesting to see that sort of approach, isn't it, of using images. But what do you think of this method? And this is very much the list method. There is one thing that was perfectly proclaimed by the fully enlightened Buddha, so we should all recite together for the benefit, welfare and happiness of devas and humans. What is this one thing? All beings are maintained by conditions. And then it's really long, this. It's called the Sanguti Sutra. And then it goes, there are two things that were perfectly proclaimed by the fully enlightened Buddha. We should all recite together for the benefit. What are those two things? And then it sort of has two. And as you see, there are 31 sets of two things that it goes into. And you've got to recite the whole thing. You know, it's actually Sanguti means singing together. So maybe they even used a tune for it, but it was probably a bit boring, you know. You know, something like the sort of, I'll sing you one, or green grow the rushes, or something like that. Anyway, so they went on to the three things, 65 lists of three, 50 sets of four things, 26 sets of five, 22 sets of six things, 14 sets of seven things, 11 sets of eight things, six sets of nine things, and six sets of 10 things. And then when they got to 10, they thought, we're exhausted, let's stop there. and it's this long sutra in the long sayings of the Buddha, the Digha Nikaya, the last sutra, I think, or the second to last one in there, Sanguti Sutta. So that's another approach. So we've got conversations or exchanges, we've got stories, we've got poems, we've got question and answer sessions, we've got images, and we've got these lists. So if you were asked which would be the most congenial or the most amenable to you, you know, if you were trying to learn about Buddhism, which would you go for? I should imagine different people would go for different things, but...
Question and answer.
You like that? The conversation type, yeah.
And
you like the lists, yes.
I like the poetry.
You like the poetry.
I like yeah.
The visual. The visual. Oh, this is good. There's somebody liking almost everything, isn't there? Nobody going for stories? I like stories. Yes. So, in a way, that's one reason, presumably, that there are so many approaches, is because people... It's not so much what we like, it's what works, you know, and different things do work for different people. For some people, a list just doesn't work at all. They just can't hold it in their mind. But that picture of the elephant going along the path, that'll really stick, you know. For other people, it may be a long piece of poetry, they can learn it. But for someone else, they can't learn that. But just four foundations of mindfulness, 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah, right, I can remember that. And I'll say a little bit more about why that more systematic approach, the list approach, can be useful. But before I do that, I want to just give an example, some very basic Buddhism. You remember I said that the way the Buddhism, the place the Buddha seems to have started from was this issue of frustration. And in fact, it said that people who can see things as they really are aware of these four truths. They're known as the Four Noble Truths. Very, very important teaching of early Buddhism. Maybe one of the very first, if not the first, teachings the Buddha himself gave after his enlightenment. So this is what they are, at least in my version of them. The truth of frustration, the cause of frustration in craving, the possibility of ending frustration in enlightenment, and the path leading to the end of frustration. So here you see this very basic Buddhist list that sort of tries to set out the priorities that are there in Buddhism. First of all, recognizing that there are issues, that there are things in life that do need dealing with. There are things wrong in life, not just in one's own life, but in other people's life. But then with this very optimistic view, first of all, you can work out why it's going wrong. It's in particular, it comes from clinging or craving, or particularly self-clinging, this sense of feeling insecure and feeling you need to hang on very strongly to maybe possessions, maybe people, maybe your own identity, your sense of yourself, all that kind of thing. But then not only have you seen the problem, but you can also see the possibility of not doing that anymore. I don't have to do that. It's easier said than done, isn't it? But you think, I don't have to do that. It's possible not to do that anymore. At first you think it would be impossible not to have suffering. But then you say, but it is possible, maybe it's possible not to have that self-clinging. So at least you can see it as a possibility. And that's the third truth. And then the fourth truth is, how do you do it? How do you deal with that clinging? How do you deal with it? And of course, in a way, that's fourth truth is the path of Buddhism, the teachings of this systematic way of dealing with our avoidance mechanisms that I talked about earlier. But then what about that path? How do you explain the path? Well, another list comes in. Because you're saying it's not enough just to say there is a path. You've got to say, well, what are the stages of that path? What do you need to deal with in that path? And so there are quite a number of teachings of the path. The simplest one is the threefold way of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. But we've also got the most famous, perhaps, the Noble Eightfold Path. We've got the path that we were looking at here on Tuesdays until recently, the path of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva, starting with generosity. So you've got different formulations, and I find that one of the most interesting sort of little exercises you can do as you get to understand Buddhism is to say, well, why are there these different ways of looking at the path? Do they, you know, are they incompatible with each other? Do they imply doing completely different things? Or can you align them? Can you work out how they fit together? And in my view, you can work out that they fit together. But again, that they appeal to different types of people. They approach things in different ways. Some paths, for example, tell you first you should be doing your meditation, then you should be practicing your wisdom and so on. Other paths may say, at the beginning of the path, your mental states will be like this. Later on, they'll be like this. It'll go through what the subjective experience is at different stages. So it looks rather different. But it's talking really about the same thing. Okay, so what about the path? That's we've got this path. But even that, what is perfect speech, for example? It's not very well saying, practice perfect speech, but we need another list in order to work out what perfect speech actually is. So he goes on to say that perfect speech needs to have four characteristics. Perfect speech needs to be truthful, it needs to be kind, it needs to be meaningful, and it needs to be harmonising. You could probably come up with more, actually, but these were four characteristics very strongly emphasised in early Buddhism. So you can see what's happening here. We started off with that basic experience of dukkha. Then that became the list of the Four Noble Truths. The fourth noble truth became that list of the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path, out of that, just one limb of that path, came the list of the four kinds of perfect speech. Now, sometimes you really don't need all this stuff, do you? Gets a bit much. Sometimes, for example, you might just hear that second noble truth. You might just get a sense of that. That's the problem of self-clinging. And you may think, that is what I'm going to work on. I'm just going to look out for it. And when it happens, I'm going to apply mindfulness and I'm just going to let go of it. And that may well be enough, that basic approach. You may find that very useful. But you do then want to know, maybe, how do I deal with craving? Maybe it's not enough just to say, every time I notice self-clinging, give it up. And the Buddha says there are quite a few things you can do. You need to follow a step-by-step path. You need to look at all the areas of your life and try to transform them. And so these lists help you to make sure you haven't left anything out. For example, it might be, if you imagine the Noble Eightfold Path without perfect speech, you might forget that communication is a really important element of our lives, because that had been left out of the list. And of course, another interesting exercise is to look through the Buddhist list and say, well, now we're in a different era, we're facing different problems, should we add something else to these lists? You know, there's some people have pointed out that perfect politics is not there. And it's got a number of other areas of life there, but politics is not mentioned. So maybe that should be added. Maybe politics was, you know, that's so far away from most people's experience in those days. You just had a king and that was it, really. But nowadays we need to be involved. Citizenship, you know, or something like that. Anyway, so as Buddhism developed, people tried to remember all these things, all these teachings, and they remember them orally in the oral tradition. Writing was known in the Buddha's time, but it was not used, and I don't completely understand why, but it wasn't used to record Buddhist teachings until several hundred years later. No paper, no pens, no ink, that could be it. But merchants used to keep records of their, you know, so people had cash books. That's what they used writing for. They used to write basic letters to each other, that sort of thing, but they didn't write down spiritual teachings, not for quite a while. They learnt them by heart. And they learnt them and they taught them to each other. They checked each other. They would, this Sanghiti Sutra I mentioned, that means singing together or chanting together. And this is what the early Buddhists would do. They'd sit down together and they'd chant what they remembered. And if they got it a bit different from each other, they'd then have a big argument and try and work out who'd remembered it wrong. And sometimes, of course, it diverged into different schools. Sometimes they would say, hang on a minute, let's look, go back to principles, first principles. Four kinds of perfect speech. What are they? Now, come on, you can remember. You were there, weren't you? You know, they'd ask somebody who was actually there when the teaching was originally given. And then in this way, the memorized lists were handed down. And I do find that lists are an aid to memory. You know, it may be a little bit boring in a way, but if you try and memorize word for word the whole teaching, you'd find it very difficult. But if you just try and memorize those Four Noble Truths, frustration, craving, enlightenment, and the path, you could probably do that quite easily. And I think it's worth you asking yourself, would that be useful? I'm assuming you don't already know them. Would it be useful if I memorized the Four Noble Truths? Would it be useful if I memorized the five precepts? Or the four kinds of perfect speech, you know? choose your own. You don't have to memorise them all, but you may find that to remember those lists, if you remember the four kinds of perfect speech, if you're somebody who faces a lot of problems in communication, you might just sort of sit down when you're in the middle of the problem and say, okay, now can I make this more truthful? Can I make it more loving, this kind of speech? Can I make it more meaningful? Can I make it more harmonising? And maybe, you know, one of those would give you, oh, of course, yes, that's what I could do, yes. It might help you. There's a Buddhist scholar who I admire quite a lot called Rupert Gethin. And he says, he wrote an article on this whole business of lists in early Buddhism and the issue of memory. In fact, it's part of a very interesting whole book on memory in Buddhism, the role of memory in Buddhism. And in fact, the word that we translate as mindfulness, or one of them, can also mean recollection. So memory was regarded as very important in early Buddhism. And he says, well, what you're trying to do, after all, with Buddhism, is to apply the teachings to your own experience. And how can you do that? Well, he says, using these lists is not... Oh, I think I've got this up here. Using these lists is not merely an aid to learning the Dharma by rote, as it were. On the contrary, the lists help one learn the Dharma with a view to its inner structure and its inner dynamic. Thus, to learn and know the lists is to learn and know how they fit together, how they interconnect and form the structure and pattern of the Dharma. And with that sense of the structure and pattern of the whole teaching, you're more likely to find ways of applying it to your own life. And this is why you want to discover the structure and pattern of the Dharma, so that you can apply it to your own experience. There are other reasons as well, actually, which I'll come to in a minute, but this is very important. So I'll give you another example of how the lists, I think, can help to make sense in a personal way of applying the Dharma. And this is looking at confidence. You probably know that confidence is regarded as a very important, crucial virtue in Buddhism. But then you'd think, well, what exactly is confidence? And I thought, well, with its modern usage, I'd say confidence is maybe something like being upbeat, being courageous in what I say and what I do, that ability to be a confident person. But in traditional Buddhism, it's a little bit more nuanced. It's a bit more subtle, the way they talk about confidence. And there's a traditional list of three, and I got this from one of the medieval Tibetan teachers, Gampopa, and he says that confidence has these three components. It's the confidence that what you do makes a difference. It makes things better or it makes things worse. Now, can you see the importance of that type of confidence? Because sometimes we think, the way I live makes no difference. What difference does it make? You know, I don't make any difference on the world around me, and even myself. You know, I'm just such a victim of the worldly winds being blown all over the place that the decisions I make aren't going to have any impact. So if you can develop that confidence that it does make a difference, how you live does make a difference, both to you and to others, you do have the ability to take some control over your life and have a beneficial effect. This is a very important aspect of confidence, and it's the basis of ethics, the basis of being an ethical person. And then the second one is the confidence that deep realizations are genuinely worthwhile. So this is taking you a step further in a way. It's saying not just to realize it makes a difference how you live, but that the deepest penetration into what's really going on is really worthwhile. The enlightenment of the Buddha, the realizations of the great teachers of the past and even of people that we know, these are really valuable. So that's the second kind of confidence. It's a little bit more like religious faith, you could say. It's faith in the existence of realization in others around us. And then the third one, the confidence that you yourself can reach these realizations. Because it's all very well, you might have that distant sort of faith that says, oh, the Buddha was wonderful, yes, wonderful. And you just sort of sit there and vicariously enjoy that. But the third kind of confidence is a self-confidence. The confidence that it is possible to move towards that. Not just maybe sort of get there straight away, but at least take steps towards those realizations. So that's another example, I think, of why these lists can be useful. And Gampopa goes on to call these the trusting confidence, the lucid confidence, and the longing confidence. And he summarizes it as a deep conviction, lucidity, and longing for those things which are real, have value, and are possible. It's a nice, again, a nice little phrase that's short enough possibly to learn by heart, if you find it useful. So it finds it makes it easier to work out what you can do with confidence. And there's a more sweeping reason, I think, for trying to discover the structure and pattern of the Dharma. And this is because I think most of us need some kind of a framework for understanding our lives, for working out what is going on, where we are in life, in a way, where we are in the context of humanity or in the context of our own groupings and so on. It's that sort of the necessity, or at least the usefulness of understanding, of having a basic framework. At least I find this. Maybe some people don't find that, but I find it very, very useful. Being able to sort of find out how things fit together. Maybe that's because I'm a scientist, or maybe that's why I became a scientist, because I was so interested in the way things fit together, the conditioning factors. And I think that the Buddha did try to construct a framework like that, and so did his followers. And it's evolved, it's adapted over the years since then. So if somebody asked you, what is the structure of Buddhism? What would you say? I don't know if it's the kind of question people do ask you, but they do sometimes, they say, what is Buddhism, don't they? Tell me what Buddhism is, you know, and it's a very difficult question to answer, isn't it?
Choice?
No, you pointed choice, out yeah. The nested set of criteria, the subsets, important subsets operating within.
Yeah.
I have made up my own little lists.
Yeah.
From my understanding of Buddhism, but I suppose I could go home and produce a tree structure.
Yeah, so you could do it in a diagrammatic way, maybe. Well, Albert, you're saying choice, that single sort of element gives you the key to it, maybe. Somebody else might say mindfulness, you know, or awareness gives you the key to it. And I'm not asking you because I think there's one answer. And, of course, the framework that you produce, David, might be quite different from the structure, the pattern that somebody else produced because of the way you... And it wouldn't be that you were wrong and they were right. So I don't think there is one answer to this question. I don't think there is an intrinsic structure either to reality or to Buddhism. Buddhism is looking at reality, and reality is simply the way it is. The structures are what we impose as we try to make sense of it. But I do think it's a very useful thing to do. You may say it's a waste of time, but I don't think it helps to see our surroundings as just being a sort of a featureless fog. It's useful to start to discern structure and start to, as you come through the fog, to say, I'm going to call that a tree, I'm going to call that a fence, I'm going to call that a road that goes into the distance, you know, and that's where I'm heading. So there are many answers. Here are some Buddhist frameworks. And in a way, what I'm showing here is different approaches to understanding things. You can see things in terms of a path. You can see things in terms of a mandala, the mandala of the five faculties. I'll have a look at that in a minute. You can see things in terms of your perception process, the five clusters or the five skandhas, which help you to see how you perceive and recognize and make sense of your experience. You can see things in terms of personality types, hate types, greed types, and delusion types, so that you can understand yourself and understand other people. Or what about the six realms on the wheel of life? Again, I'll show you a picture of that in a minute, so that you can understand and sympathize with others. Reality as a whole, we can see that in terms of conditionality, that the interconnected webs of conditionings that make things happen the way they do, that make things fit together, interconnectedness. More mythically, we could look at the families of the different archetypal Buddhas. You'll find that in later Buddhism, you have this sense of dividing your understanding of your path and of yourself into the different Buddha families, the white Buddha in the middle, the green Buddha in the north, and the yellow Buddha in the south, and the red Buddha in the west, and the blue Buddha in the east, and lots of stuff about that. I'll show you a little bit of that picture in a minute. So here's one example. I've already mentioned the example of the Eightfold Path. Here's another example of a path, a framework that we use particularly in Triratna, the necessity for integration, the necessity for cultivating positive emotion, and then what's called spiritual death, which means starting just to let go of self-clinging, so that you let go of an obsession with this sort of absolutely existing me that is like this. You let that fall away. And then spiritual rebirth, where you construct, as it were, a more loose and more open you, a more open personality. And compassionate activity, where you express this openness in involvement with the world. So, I mean, all of these things, of course, we can have whole talks about them. So I hope it doesn't feel too frustrating for me to skip through all these lists. I just want to give you a sense of the structure of Buddhism. And some of these, you may think, oh, I'd like to explore that further. Others maybe just won't really touch you. As a mandala, we've got the mandala of the five faculties. Mindfulness, central, because that keeps things in balance. And then we need to make sure that confidence, which is a strongly emotional response, balances wisdom, which can be more intellectual. You don't go overboard in either direction. Similarly, meditation, which is rather inward and reflective, balanced by enthusiasm, action, energy, which is much more engaged and active. So another quite useful structure, this, the mandala structure, making sure that you're not missing something crucial out. And then, sorry about this, not a terribly good picture, but I just wanted to give you a reminder at least of the six realms for understanding human life, human personalities, the stages of life we're at. So we've got the realm of the gods or the angelic beings at the top here. We've got the realm of the tormented beings down here. We've got the animals in this small realm here. These are human beings doing all sorts of human things, making love, ploughing the ground, making things, chatting to each other, going on journeys and so on. And here we've got the angry gods, the jealous gods, constantly fighting. And here we've got the hungry ghosts in constant states of craving. And I find this really useful. To have that sense of, well, sometimes, what am I at the moment? Am I a hungry ghost? Am I in an addictive phase of my personality? Am I one of the aggressive gods? Am I being very competitive? Or what? And I do find this useful, this sort of structure. However, there are drawbacks, it seems to me, to all this. And I think we need to remind ourselves of these drawbacks, that you can get caught up in a systematic approach if you take it too literally. If you want to lock down reality, another one I don't mention here is William Blake's famous saying, where he says, I must create my own system or be enslaved by another man's. So I do think we need to make sense of things ourselves. These structures can be useful, but you do need, I think, to hang loose from them. And watch out for that loss of integrity that can come if you impose some external system on your experience. Your experience is primary. That's what really matters, is what's actually going on. These things can be useful for making sense of experience, but they mustn't swamp your experience by insisting on cramming them into somebody else's categories. So although I do really love these lists and these systems, I think I have to remind myself of this. And the final picture I want to show you, you may have noticed this. We've got it up by the bookshop over there. And this is somebody's attempt within our own Sri Ratna movement to sort of have a one wall chart with the whole of Buddhism on it. It's quite an ambitious thing to do, really, isn't it? But interesting. I think I won't say all that much about it, but I just want to say, just look at the way he started it. I don't know how easy it is for you to read this from where you are. Actually, it's not very easy at all, is it? So you're not the small print. He started from Pratityasamutpada, which means conditionality. He said, in a way, that's the key into Buddhism, from his point of view. That's the key. That's the way everything fits together. And he's noticed that conditionality traditionally has five departments. The physical department, the area of physics and the weather and all that kind of thing. The biological department or the organic department, where we understand the processes of life, of reproduction, of physiology and so on. The mind department, psychology, where you understand the non-volitional parts of the mind, the instincts, our natural tendencies and so on. And these are, he doesn't go into much detail with these are the areas of, this is where science is, this area here. And then Buddhism is bigger because he's gone into more detail. Of course, this is the whole of science, so you can make this really big as well if you wanted to. But then he goes into the karma area, and that's to the area of volitional action. And this is the area where the lists come in, because the lists are where you're deliberately trying to work on yourself. And then the Dharma Nyama, where you can say much less about it, this is the area of direct experience, direct realization. But it can be summarized by the mandala of the five Buddhas that I mentioned earlier. The blue one in the east at the bottom, the yellow one, the red one, the green one, the white one in the middle, symbolizing different aspects of realization or of knowledge. So what he's got here is the Wheel of Life with the different realms. You remember the hell realms, the praetors, which is the hungry ghosts, the ashras, the jealous gods, and so on. And then this loopy little path that takes you through the states of meditation up towards the mandala. And another path here, meditation, ethics, wisdom. So Emma brought back some of these. If you really want to get some of these Buddhist lists, you're welcome to buy one of these. They're rather expensive, unfortunately, because they were done at a small number. But see Mariangela, she's got some. If you want to take one home, it's quite nice and big, and you can go and study it, and then I'll examine you on it next week and see what you can remember. So I think I'm going to leave it there. This offers you a structure, it offers you a set of lists, but there's also an image, or there are images that help you make sense of where you are now, and also have a sense of what your next step is going to be, and give you perhaps a vision of human potential, a vision of the Buddha. And so that's a little summary, if you like, of structure in Buddhism. And if you're interested, explore it further. Have a look. Find out the list that you want to learn. Find out the methods that work best for you, the stories or the images or whatever.